trusted voice of truth and light.
God gave me a gift. I shovel well. I shovel very well.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
We've got a blind date with destiny.
And it looks like she's ordered the lobster.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there and welcome to the show. This program is all about encouraging you to think as clearly and independently as possible. So I'm inviting you to disagree with me whenever you think it's necessary. Because truth be told, I don't have all the answers, and I won't pretend that I do. There are some things I feel like I've paid the price to where I feel comfortable with committing to the truth of something, but I also try to keep an open mind, and I also understand that so much of what I know about any given subject was told to me by someone else, which means if I really want to know something, I've got to be willing to dig, do my own original thinking, my own original research, and come to my own conclusions, rather than just parrot, you know, what somebody's told me to say. I'm urging you to take a similar approach, with the full knowledge that eventually you're going to outgrow me. You won't need me. You'll be like, thanks, Brian, but I got it from here, and on you'll go on your journey towards the light. So I'm actually happy to see that happen, because I believe that the kind of leadership that we need today is not, you know, somebody creating more followers. I don't want a massive audience of followers. I want to reach the hearts of those people out there who are leaders, who recognize that they have leadership capacity and responsibility and are willing to step up and act on it. And I think those numbers are actually pretty small, but it doesn't matter, because they're going to go out there and they're going to create more leaders, because that's what good leaders do. Got some great sponsors who make the show possible. Let me give a quick thanks to them. GovernYourCrypto.com, the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage, LifesavingFood.com, MonticelloCollege.org, SewingAndQuiltingCenter.com, HSLAmmo.com, and also Dixie Chiropractic, which is DixieChiro.com. All right, this is the topic on so many people's minds, and I stay unplugged from the media as much as possible, but it's very clear the memo has gone out, and you've no doubt caught wind of the growing media fervor over monkeypox. Oh, it's everywhere. It's so scary. And I've got a great article here from Mike Whitney pointing out how convenient this outbreak is just as the World Health Organization is in the midst of seeking greater power. His approach is, hey, fool me twice, shame on me. Starts with a quote from Robin Monati. I can't believe it's monkeypox season already, and I haven't even taken down my Ukrainian decorations yet. He says, Bill Gates' prediction that the world would face an unexpected smallpox outbreak is miraculously unfolding. Should we be surprised? In this case, Mike Whitney says, I'm not. Here's the money quote that was delivered by Gates 6 months before the first case was recorded. Quote, this is from November 6th, 2021, Bill Gates in Sky News. He says, it'll probably take about $1 billion a year for a pandemic task force at the World Health Organization level, which is doing the surveillance and actually doing what I call germ games, where you practice, you say, okay, what if a bioterrorist brought smallpox to 10 airports? You know, how would the world respond to that? End quote. Now, Mike Whitney says, you know, one can only marvel at Gates' extraordinary powers of perception. He's like some kind of software soothsayer able to divine the future from the entrails of animals. Is it that, or does he have a crystal ball tucked away somewhere in the bowels of his Lake Washington mansion? Whatever it is, it's truly astonishing. Here's more from the World Socialist website. An unprecedented outbreak of monkeypox virus has officially spread to 10 countries outside of Africa, with 107 confirmed or suspected cases reported as of this writing. 9 cases in the UK, 34 in Portugal, 32 in Spain, 1 in France, 2 in Belgium, 1 in Sweden, 3 in Italy, 22 in Canada, 2 in the United States, 1 in Australia. Much remains unknown about what is causing the outbreak, which is the most geographically dispersed and rapidly spreading monkeypox outbreak since the virus was first discovered in 1958. In the coming days and weeks, more data and scientific understanding will emerge. But already, there is profound concern within the scientific community and among the public. which has found wide expression on social media. Okay, end quote. So, the most rapidly spreading monkeypox outbreak since the virus was first discovered in 1958. Mike Whitney says, I wonder if that rapidly spreading part has something to do with the way that researchers have been tweaking the gain of function of these unique pathogens in order to make them more contagious and more lethal. Is that what's going on? Well, he says, we'll probably never know. And is it fair to ask whether monkeypox might be another lab-generated virus that was conducted in the 300 or so Pentagon-funded secret labs sprinkled around the world that are presently conducting a massive war on humanity to further the ambitions of billionaire elites who are committed to reducing the global population while imposing strict police state surveillance on every sentient being on planet Earth? Yeah, we probably won't get an answer to that one either. Now, in the interest of fairness, though, he says, we should mention that reputable media outlets like Newsweek magazine have refuted the claim that Gates made the prediction that we allude to above. Here's Newsweek's explanation. Quote, while Gates has talked about the possibility of bioterrorist smallpox attacks in the past, his comments have been drawn slightly out of context and don't mention monkeypox. End quote. Slightly out of context? You mean Gates did not draw attention to a particular infectious disease, smallpox, that magically reemerged from extinction just months later? What context is the author talking about? We'd like to know. Mike Whitney says, strictly speaking, it doesn't matter what Newsweek says or doesn't say. After all, Gates has become the embodiment of everything that's wrong with today's public health Gestapo, which is why he's a magnet for criticism. And whether he's been treated fairly or not, a sizable number of people believe quite strongly that Gates is the mastermind behind a plan to use lab-generated infectious diseases to subjugate the global population in order to establish a tyrannical new order to subjugate the global population and to control them by various elites like him, by voracious elites, rather, like himself. Mike Whitney says the World Health Organization's new sovereignty eviscerating treaty further underscores this point. In fact, it seems to suggest that Gates and his fellow travelers believe their lifelong ambition to rule the world is now within grasp. Here's a summary of this World Health Organization pandemic treaty. Measures specifically provided for in the regulations include lockdowns, hard borders and quarantine zones, vaccine passports, mandatory contact tracing, mandatory health tests, mandatory removal and quarantine, global government control. Well, that sounds so reasonable. I mean, come on, we've seen these things used to address COVID. And now the World Health Organization is voting on a treaty that would apply the same standard to every single nation that's a part of that treaty. That's kind of spooky. And the timing, you have to admit the timing. And now there's a monkeypox outbreak. Why, it's exactly the little push that we need to get things to move. Mike Whitney says, in researching this article, I stumbled across a number of tidbits that readers might find interesting. For example, I discovered there's been a tabletop exercise simulating a global pandemic involving an unusual strain of monkeypox that took place in March of 2021. It's astonishing how many of these preparatory drills seem to take place just prior to some particularly horrific event. Can we dismiss them all as mere coincidences? Check out this blurb from the Brownstone Institute. Media outlets around the world are on red alert over the world's first ever global outbreak of monkeypox in mid-May 2022, just 1 year after an international biosecurity conference in Munich held a simulation of a global pandemic involving an unusual strain of monkeypox beginning in mid-May 2022. It also says monkeypox was first identified in 1958, but there's never been a global monkeypox outbreak outside of Africa until now. In the exact week of the exact month predicted by the biosecurity folks in their pandemic simulation. Take these guys to Vegas. And finally, from the Brownstone Institute, the global monkeypox outbreak occurring on the exact timeline predicted by a biosecurity simulation of a global monkeypox outbreak a year prior bears a striking resemblance to the outbreak of COVID-19 just months after Event 201, a simulation of a coronavirus pandemic, almost exactly like COVID-19. Now, there's actually a video linked in that excerpt above that says, scientists have decided that this monkeypox virus was engineered. This was part of the simulated outbreak. What do you think that means?
Uh-huh.
We're seeing far fewer cases where governments took early and decisive actions. Could it mean we better prepare ourselves for another round of experimental clot shots? Is that what it means? There's more to this article by Mike Whitney. I'm going to leave it for you to discover. I think it's well worth your while, though. Take a little bit of time and check this out. I'm not telling you you have to believe it, but if you have any inkling that we were fooled in a big way when it came to the overstating of the danger of COVID, etc., you might want to take a real close look at anything being told to you about monkeypox and the need for all of us to shut up and fall in line and do what we're told. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. I would like to send some love in the direction of sewingandquiltingcenter.com. This wonderful business is located in southern Utah, and it has everything, and I mean everything you could possibly need to not only get into the game when it comes to sewing or embroidery or to long-arm quilting, but also to stay in the game and to make it part of your family heritage. The more I look at it, the more I realize, you know, this is one of those skills that will always be valuable, at least as long as people are wearing clothes. If we get to the point where, you know, clothing optional becomes the norm, well then, what can I say? But for clothes, for blankets, for pillows, for just repairing the clothing you have, it seems like a great bet. And the wonderful thing about Sewing and Quilting Center is they not only sell machines from the very entry-level models up to the very top-of-the-line high-end models like long-arm quilters, they service what they sell. They'll teach you how to use what you've bought from them. Free classes to show you how to get the most out of your machine. And they have all the supplies, the thread, the needles, everything you need to make it all work. Check them out. There's a link in my show notes to sewingandquiltingcenter.com. You know, one of the greatest gifts that we can give our kids is the ability to become a can-do individual. Lenore Scanese has a great article published on intellectualtakeout.org that spells out the lost milestones of childhood and also talks about the power of seeing your kid blossom, which she says is more powerful than worrying about their every move. Lenore Scanese says, with the popularity of Netflix's Old Enough, that's the Japanese show featuring kids ages 2 to 6 running errands, parents here in America have been wondering what age their kids can start safely doing the same. So she says, allow me to give my opinion. After 15 years of studying just this topic, now obviously every neighborhood and every child is different, which is why it's up to the parent, not the neighbors or the in-laws or even the state, to decide when kids are ready for some independence. But she says, this is hard to figure out in a culture where childhood's parameters have been shrinking faster than the rainforest. In fact, she says, look at this amazing map of how children lost the right to roam in 4 generations. And this map will show you. An 88-year-old great-grandpa says he used to wander 6 miles as a child. His son-in-law, a grandpa now in his 60s, used to walk 1 mile in his childhood. His daughter, age 36, walked 0.5 mile to school. And now the great-grandchild, age 8, is not allowed beyond the end of his street. And barely even goes there. His mom drives him to school. That sound familiar? Lenore Scanese says that's been the story in much of the English-speaking world, leading to first-world problems like skyrocketing rates of childhood depression and anxiety. So when a parent is thinking, is it safe to let my child run some errands alone? They should also be thinking, is it safe not to let my child do anything independently, considering the rates of serious childhood mental health issues that are going up as childhood independence is going down? So that then is the first rule of thumb. She says, don't assume perfect safety can be achieved by keeping your kids in a Rapunzel-like state. Think outside the tower. So, how about walking to school alone? Once again, it depends on the child, the neighborhood, and all sorts of things like whether there are sidewalks or stop signs or roving bands of rabid wolves. Parents should just walk to school or the store or whatever with their child a few times to teach them how to navigate. She says, it's hard for you to cross the street because there's so much traffic, so of course it'll be hard for them too. It's simply a matter of teaching them to look both ways, which is what I was taught as a kid. Look left, look right, look left again. Then our job as parents is to make sure they understand when, why, and how to do this. Now, what's interesting about old enough is that it's not that the parents aren't nervous, and it's not that the kids aren't sometimes a little scared, too. It's that worry alone is not considered reason enough not to let a child start doing something. The reason the show is so charming is that the kids and parents triumph over some worries and hiccups. She's got a good point here. There can be no growth without trying something new and a little bit daunting. If you're feeling comfortable, you're probably not growing, is how I would explain it. Lenore Scanese says, what I've seen over and over again, and I actually hosted a similar show called World's Worst Mom on Discovery Life TV, now it's on YouTube, is that the fear is far more fragile than it seems. See, on her show, she says, I took kids of extremely anxious parents away from them for a couple of afternoons and sent them to do things like climb a tree, ride the bus, go get some bread. Even one mom who was still feeding her 10-year-old as if he was a baby or toddler ended up insanely proud of her son when, with her prodding, with Lenore Scanese's prodding, he learned to ride a bike and then went on an overnight. Mom's fear was replaced by pride and joy. And guess what? So was his. It happens in old enough. And it happens even with very nervous, anxious parents in our country. But she says, seeing your kid blossom is even more powerful than worrying about their every move. Pride and love melt away the anxiety in both generations. Maybe your own kid is old enough for this transformation too. Interesting thought. I've got a link to her article. It's in my show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. If you haven't subscribed to my show notes, I would strongly encourage you do so. I'll include at least 8 good articles in each edition of the show notes that you can read at your leisure. You can follow the links within them and get yourself a pretty solid understanding of pretty much any topic covered on the show. But I'm also thinking about this in terms of just the practicality of helping your kids become more self-resilient. And more self-reliant, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Resilience is a part of this. Been having this conversation actually with a number of friends about, you know, how do you teach a kid to be strong and to be okay with encountering difficulty? See, there's a false premise out there that teaches us that, well, you know, if you're doing your job as a parent, your kid should never encounter any kind of challenge or difficulty or stress in their lives. In other words, you're going to make it as easy for them as possible so they don't have to struggle like you and I did. And the wisest people I've known are the ones who've said, I don't want my kid to have that struggle-free existence. Like the butterfly coming out of its cocoon, you need that struggle. And you know what? They need the ability to make mistakes too. So, you know, this is hard. And I flunked this test many times before I realized, oh, wait, they need to have the ability to fail. So when your kid comes to you, Dad, can I make a grilled cheese sandwich? And you know darn good and well that smoke detector is going to be going off in about 5 minutes. You still give them the opportunity. I like how Lenore Scanese says, look, like, for instance, taking them to the store, walking them to school. You can show them the right way to do it. But at some point, you got to be willing to turn them loose and let them figure it out for themselves. And it's a guarantee on most things they're going to be making some mistakes. I remember at 5 years old, my mom walking me to school and my friends' moms, you know, they all walked us to kindergarten. And I think that only happened maybe once or twice. And then we were on our own. And, you know, for the most part, it worked very well. There was, of course, the day that my friends and I don't remember what exactly got into us. We took a slightly different route home and ended up walking past a construction site. And there was this home under construction and it was just framed, no windows or doors or anything in there. But we were standing on this hill above this new home under construction and I don't know what got into us, but as 5-year-olds, it sure seemed like, you know, the smartest thing we could do is stand here and throw rocks at this construction site. Now, nobody was working at the site, so there was nobody there to chase us off, but We stood there and were happily throwing rocks and making this tremendous racket, hearing them rattle around off the boards inside and, you know, seeing if we could get them through the open windows and whatnot. And pretty soon, one of my friend's moms came and gently corrected us and herded us on back down the path to get home. So, yeah, even the kids will make mistakes from time to time. Still, it was a good learning experience, and we had absolute confidence from that time forward that if mom says walk to school, I didn't need somebody to hold my hand and, you know, sing me love songs on the way there. Think about the risks you were allowed to take as a kid. Would you allow your kids or your grandkids to take those kind of risks? And if the answer is no, the problem may not be that the world's changed so much. It may be that you and I have a bad mindset.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Welcome back to the show. Want to say a couple of words about lifesavingfood.com. I don't know if you have been following some of the news headlines, but it's a little bit spooky when you read about what is happening economically as well as in the food supply chain. And, you know, I try not to just glom onto, well, here's the worst possible news. It looks like we're all going to be starving in about 6 months. Okay, I don't need that kind of sensational approach, but I think there are some legitimately bad things that are happening that will come on very gradually and then very suddenly. And to me, the smart bet is while you have the opportunity, while there is still plenty of food and plenty of things on the shelves and still plenty of inventory to be put away, you should probably go ahead and act sooner than later. Again, I'm not trying to scare you, but it's very clear that from the people in authority, several different choke points are being created or have been created that are going to drastically impact not just our supply of food here in America, but the world supply of food. That's something you ought to take very seriously, especially if you have any inkling of how historically food has been used as a mechanism of control. Buy yourself some time. Buy yourself options. Lifesavingfood.com is one of the ways you can do that. So you want to know what real freedom feels like? Well, forgive my language here. This is the title of an article by Gary Barnett. I do not give a damn what other people think. This is an indication of respect. And he starts with a quote from Harold Pinter, from a book called Conversations with Pinter. I don't give a damn what other people think. It's entirely their own business. I'm not writing for other people. And this is an attitude that if you're serious about being free, you've got to learn to embrace this. Well, it sounds uncomfortable, Brian. It is, at first. And then you wonder how you ever lived without it or why you ever gave yourself over to needing the approval of other people. Gary Barnett says, now that we understand each other, it's time to clear the air on a few matters. And he says, if my comments here seem disagreeable or offended in any way, just remember, I don't give a damn. I don't mean this disrespectfully. It's just that your thoughts are yours and mine are mine. I have no time to waste worrying about what others think about me, what I believe, what I know, or what I write. If I were to spend my days wringing my hands over such nonsense, my entire life would consist of only worry over things of which I have no power to change, not that I would anyway. It's not that I do not have curiosity, compassion, or even agreement with some of the thoughts and ideas of others, you see. It's just that it makes no difference what you or I think about each other's opinions, only that we are honest with ourselves. With that said, he says, I will outline some of my positions so there is no misunderstanding and no doubt as to where I stand. Before we go on with what he stands for, I strongly recommend, if you haven't taken the time to write down, I'm not going to call it a manifesto because that seems like a really poisonous word right now, but a simple document, a simple declaration of these are the things that I believe, this is what I stand for. If you haven't done that, you owe it to yourself to do so. It will give you clarity. It'll take things out of the abstract, just rattling around in your head, and put them into the tangible, in black and white, on paper. You might even be a little surprised at what you learn about yourself. So for Gary Barnett, he says, you know, if you want to know where I stand, here goes. First, he says, I am an anarchist, pure and simple, which means I am not conservative or liberal, a misused word, not left or right, Republican or Democrat or libertarian for that matter. Now, he says, for those unable to comprehend proper language or who are not willing to do the 5 minutes of research necessary to understand the real meanings of words, I will explain. Anarchy, from the French, Greek, and Latin roots of our language, means in essence without rulers or without rule, nothing more. In other words, it means no belief in government or anyone or any group ruling over another. It does not mean total chaos, rioting, property destruction, violence, lawlessness, or any other such bastardized meanings falsely attributed by political propagandists and accepted by the ignorant populations of today. That's quite a red pill, huh? He says, because of this, I also believe in total non-aggression or no use of force against another without legitimate cause. Now, cause does not mean the state warring against its own or other countries. It means in actual defense of self and family in the presence of active or physical threat, or intent to cause harm to a person or property, or infringement on liberty. Self-defense has no limits, in my opinion, other than once the threat is squelched, all force must cease. Some, like the great Murray Rothbard, understood in reality the idea of non-aggression, but many take them to the term too literally and simplistically, usually in an effort to destroy the very essence of the axiom. They desire to search for alternative methods and exceptions in order to destroy the very natural idea of non-aggression. This is a gross contradiction. All boils down to the individual, not the ridiculous collective common good, and that's why those who disagree with non-aggression are always politically motivated. That's a good point. He says, it stands to reason then that I abhor war, all war. War is brutal and murderous aggression by nation states. Considering this country called the United States of America, it has always initiated and participated in aggression and war, at least 94% of its existence. It matters not which war is considered, whether the heinous war against American Indians, the war of northern aggression called the Civil War, World War I or World War II, the Vietnam War, the Middle Eastern War, or the so-called War on or of Terror, or any other war or conflict purposely manufactured and prosecuted by the ruling classes. War is simply a tool used by the state to acquire money and property by theft, to advance geopolitical agendas, to gain power and control not only over the pretended enemy, but in most cases to gain power over its own people, to extinguish freedom of the individual, and to eliminate populations. He just comes right out and says there is no such thing as a good war. Now, this means that the enforcement arms of government, whether state or federal police, the state and federal courts, the entirety of the military, the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, the IRS, and any and all other bureaucracies built and sustained by government enforcement services are, generally speaking, atrocious by nature. They are simply the lieutenants and henchmen of the political and criminal mafia that is the U.S. government. Their mission is not one of justice, protection, mercy, or compassion. It's one of brute force, meant to operate on orders given by the ruling class. As a whole, he says, they are very corrupt, dangerous, and in most cases evil. The very idea that individual responsibility and liability for heinous acts perpetrated by those accepting orders from above is absent or not evident is anathema to any moral or ethical society. So he says, in view of what I've previously stated, I think it's important I should discuss my views on the U.S. Constitution. Immediately, it should be evident that any piece of paper or parchment drafted by politicians and being called the law of the land should first be vehemently distrusted before being heavily scrutinized. Considering this particular document, one revered by most and even held sacred by many as guided by God, is necessary for a little background. He says, our initial contribution, which was anything but perfect, were the Articles of Confederation. These articles allowed for no president, for no power for the federal government to tax any state or citizen directly, no federal control of commerce, no total power over money, as the states retained most powers, with Congress simply being the final arbiter. On paper, at least, these articles did actually restrict the national or federal government. The current Constitution, however, destroyed completely that premise, as all restrictions on federal power disappeared with the new Constitution. As Gary Barnett has stated on many occasions, can anyone even imagine today a few politicians on their own and in secret, Democrats or Republicans or any combination of the two, overhauling the government, creating a new set of rules, replacing the current government, and drafting those rules by secret ballot? Politicians, legal scholars, professors, academics, and any number of others are fond of claiming the U.S. Constitution severely limits government and protects the individual from tyranny. They claim that all federal powers are explicitly limited due to the written restrictions contained in that founding document. But he says this is simply not true. Why, where are these so-called restrictions? There are none, as far as I see, in Article 1, Section 8. And this is the one article that outlines all the powers of Congress. Now, I've got to tap the brakes here because we're coming up on our own break here. He talks about how there are no such things as constitutional rights and so forth, but his bottom line is government is always the enemy and never the solution. Negating government interference, ignoring its mandates and commands, practicing personal responsibility, eliminating all government power in favor of the individual, and striking it down at every opportunity can only bring more peace and harmony, freedom, cooperation, and an end to war against all of us and others. So think what you will, he says, and I will do the same, and as long as mutual respect is present, well then, he says, we'll all be better off, and a better world will be the result. I agree with a lot of what he's saying here. I, for one, do hold that the Constitution, I think, was a remarkable instrument. And I believe when it's followed, it actually does a remarkable job of providing us with good government. That's okay if we agree to disagree.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
All right, welcome back to the show. One of the things that I miss about my carefree days of when I was underemployed, underpaid, but having so much fun is I had so much time to read. And, of course, since growing up and taking the responsibilities of an adult on my shoulders, I don't have as much reading time as I once had. But to me, the idea of the perfect vacation is me in a comfortable place to sit with good lighting and plenty of time and something great to read. And I'm talking a tangible, physical book in my hands, not just an electronic, you know, Nook or something like that. I love the feeling of pages under my fingers, and I love the idea of reading. And I think I just got some inspiration for another book that I'm going to have to drag out and read. I was reading on LouRockwell.com today an article by Ira Katz about That Hideous Strength, which is a C.S. Lewis story. And I thought this was a very relevant story. C.S. Lewis is one of my favorite writers for a number of reasons. But I want you to hear Ira Katz's take on this particular book, That Hideous Strength. He says, when I'm on a driving trip with my family, it's my daughter's music or nothing on the media player. So I took the opportunity on a recent solo trip to listen to an audiobook, Out of the Silent Planet. That's the first of the Space Trilogy by C.S. Lewis. Now he says, I've read a lot of Lewis, but I'm not normally a fan of science fiction or fantasy. But Heather Haying mentioned this book on the Dark Horse podcast that she co-hosts with her husband, Brett Weinstein. So when I came across the free audio version, I went for it. As free audio versions of the other two novels in the trilogy, Paralandra and That Hideous Strength were also available, I listened to them too. But he says, here I'm going to write about That Hideous Strength. And by the way, he links to an online version of the story. So if you don't want to buy the book, you can actually read it online, or the story anyway. In Out of the Silent Planet, Dr. Elwin Ransom, a professor of philosophy, a branch of knowledge that deals with the structure, historical development, and relationships of a language or languages, is kidnapped and transported to Mars. While there, he meets the planet's various inhabitants and discovers the Earth is exiled from the rest of the solar system. In Paralandra, Ransom is transported to Venus, called Paralandra, to continue a battle against the evil forces exiled on Earth, but doing mischief on this new planet. In both books, Lewis went wild describing the landscape, the beings, and their languages of the Mars, or of the planets Mars and Venus. Now, the influence of fellow members of the Inklings is apparent. I suppose this is all good if you like that sort of thing. But the story that hideous strength is set on Earth, a scientific think tank called NICE, which stands for National Institute of Coordinated Experiments, is secretly in touch with demonic entities who plan to assume control of the Earth. Dr. Ransom is leading a small band against great potential danger to the human race and the planet. Now, Ira Katz says, 25 years ago, I taught a seminar for first-year university students. The concept for the course came from the university. This course is intended to induct the student into an intellectual discussion of substantive issues and to enhance their speaking, writing, and bibliographic skills. He says, I described my version of the seminar in the syllabus. The topic of this particular seminar is truth. The seminar will begin with readings from philosophy and theology, which will lead to the question of the meaning of personal existence and hence the truth of morals. We will next consider the role of truth in the academic disciplines, history, and science. The following topic is the application of truth in the professions such as law, journalism, and politics. The final areas of discussion will be on the arts and aesthetics, in that when we call something good, do we imply an objective truth? And he says, I thought a lot about what makes a good novel. And I came to the conclusion that a good novel exposes the truth of the human condition through giving the reader a sense of the inner workings of the minds of the characters, and hence of other people. So a prime example of this is Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky. I would now add that goodness can include giving the reader a vivid description of a particular place and time. As an example, I include the Aubrey Maturin series of sea novels by Patrick O'Brien. A further way to judge a novel, if it is old enough, is through its prescience. Orwell's 1984 comes to many people's minds today for its explanatory power of the current world situation. So Ira Katz says, that hideous strength is a good book on at least two of these levels, even if the overall composition is lacking for me, just because he says science fiction and fantasy are not to my taste. But the first important lesson comes from understanding of the key character, an academic social scientist who spirals into evil. He wants to be on the inside, so he is easily turned to do evil works. He was miseducated to believe in a pseudo-religious scientism. And Ira Katz says, see this recent discussion with Dr. Wolfgang Smith, where he describes this ideological view of the world. He says explicitly that there exist bad spiritual forces that drive modern science. Now, Lewis's emphasis on organizations is brilliant. Any perceptive reader who's been in the military, worked for a corporation, or even has been a professor in a university will recognize the world of middle managers. The counterexample of NICE is the bottom-up organization of Ransom's little band of apostles. The other important lesson comes from Lewis's prescience that's evident in the grand conspiracy, false flags, press manipulation, and the eugenics mindset that are so prevalent today and emanate from the same Scientology or the same ideology of scientism. Sorry, that was an interesting Freudian slip there. Please don't sue me. Anyway, in a recent post, the Bionic Mosquito quotes from The Abolition of Man, pointing out the destruction of society follows the education like that of the social scientist character in that hideous strength. Quote, albeit not overtly and maybe not even consciously, that words need not have meaning, that qualities are nothing more than personal feelings, and that there need not be anything objective in either. In fact, there can be nothing objective in either. End quote. Now, Ira Katz says, in the preface to That Hideous Strength, Lewis explains explicitly that this is a tall story about devilry, though it has behind it a serious point, which I've tried to make in my Abolition of Man. In the story, the outer rim of that devilry had to be shown touching the life of some ordinary and respectable profession. I selected my own profession, not, of course, because I think fellows of colleges more likely to be thus corrupted than anyone else, but because my own profession is naturally that which I know best. End quote. By the way, Ira Katz says the course that he was teaching did not go very well. In fact, he says, one young woman, as they were walking out of class, she told him, I don't like your class. And he said that was surprising because students were normally less direct in those days. So when I asked her why, she responded, I have to think too much. I'm going to include a link to this in the show notes for today and encourage you to read the story, That Hideous Strength, as well as Ira Katz's review of it. And I can kind of identify with this. I'm no college professor. I'm not a smart person. I am a person who does love truth, and I love to inquire. I have an inquisitive mind. The National Enquirer would love somebody like me because I want to know. But I love people who can answer questions and make me think. And that's something I've tried to do over the years in addressing my listeners. I like to make them think, or to encourage them to think. And like the young woman walking out of Ira Katz's class, I hear from them on occasion. You know, you suck. That's one of the worst, you know, insults. But they will tell me it upsets them because it requires too much thinking, or I don't like to think too deeply about things. Now, the flip side of that is there are also people who are very grateful and who welcome the opportunity to think. And they quickly outpace me and they zoom along, leaving me in their dust. And that's totally okay. But if you really want to understand the world around you, and if you really want to have a great, solid foundation of who you are and what you stand for, you have to be willing to think too much. You have to be willing to think at a level to which it's actually difficult. And I know we don't equate thinking with physical exercise. Well, you know, I worked up quite a sweat, you know, it's like an Iron Man for my mind. But sometimes it's like that. I think it was Mortimer Adler, who was one of the great advocates of literacy and one of the people who helped to compile the great books of Western civilization with the University of Chicago, talked about how real thinking is hard work. He likened it to climbing a rope by hand, hand over hand, working your way upward, you know, sweat pouring down your face. And I can tell you it is a lot like that. There is real effort involved and there is sacrifice involved. And the hardest part of all is when you bump into truths that fall outside of your mental universe. This is where some people puff up and become the gorilla version of themselves and want to just, you know, bang their chest and get all dominant and angry. It's hard to admit, ooh, I didn't know that, and then assimilate that new truth into your life. Why would someone do all this? Because it's absolutely worth it.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.